about quantum information from last week. But we can not exactly test that, but in case you've forgotten something, here's a good opportunity to ask questions about what you forgot. Or, you know, stuff that you didn't forget that you never knew but were curious about. No questions yet? Still waking up, I guess. Okay. So let me remind you a little bit. So on Friday, we were starting to talk about complexity theory. So I'm going to say a little bit more about that today and then start on quantum algorithms. So remember we defined the notion of a language as a set of bit strings that represents the yes instances of a decision problem. And a complexity class is a set of languages. And we defined on Friday two particularly interesting complexity classes that, that show up a lot in this field. One of them is P. So then P is the class of problems which there exists a polynomial time classical algorithm. And then BQP, which was the class for which there exists a polynomial time quantum algorithm. And remember that the quantum algorithm had to be correct. If it's a quantum measurement being random, there's only some probability that it gets the right answer. And in particular, we picked the probability to be 2/3. And of course, this is a probability taken over, for instance, different runs of the same algorithm, not over different problem instances. So it has to work in both this case and this case. The algorithm has to run in this amount of time and be correct on every input. Okay, even the hardest ones. And remember, we're quantifying polynomial time as a function of the size of the inputs, the number of bits needed to describe the input to the problem. Okay? Does this sound familiar? Okay. So let's move on. So another very well-known complexity class, but that's harder in some sense than these two, although not necessarily harder than BQP, is the famous class NP. And so NP stands actually not for not polynomial, as a lot of people think, but for non-deterministic polynomial. It's going to be defined as follows. Actually, one way you can define it is using a funny thing called a non-deterministic Turing machine, which I'm not going to define it that way, but that's the source of this name. So NP is the complexity class, and it consists of languages and the property of these languages is that there's some algorithm which doesn't find the answer, but it verifies the answer. So the verifier is actually a function of two inputs, and this verifier should have three properties. So first of all, it should run in polynomial time. For all inputs x, and for all w, so for all x and w, with w, the size of w being only polynomial in the size of x. So So W is called the witness. Let me finish the definition, and then I'll write that. Okay. So if we have an X that's in the language, the property of this verifier should be that there exists a W that will convince us that it actually is in the language. So for all X and L, there exists W sub X with, again, W sub X is the size of W sub X is polynomial in the size of X, and V of X, WX, is yes. And if X is not in the language, then for all W, the verifier will reject. And again, we're restricting to W, whose size is polynomial in X. V of X, W equals no. And as I said, W is the witness. W sub X, I guess, in the yes case, is the witness for yes instance. Okay? So let's unpack this definition a little bit. So I kind of said out loud the main points. The idea, remember, is that, so first of all, there's an asymmetry between the yes and the no cases. Okay? So the point is that if you have a yes instance of this problem, there should be something that can prove to you that it really is a yes instance. And if it's no instance, then there should be no way to prove to you that it's a yes instance, because it's not. Right? So that's what these things say. So first of all, this just says that the verifier is an efficient procedure. Right? It runs in polynomial time. This one says that if it's a yes instance, then here's some information, W sub X, that can convince us that it really is a yes instance. And it convinces us because we run the verifier and see that it accepts. Okay? And the reason we should accept that is because of property 3, which is that if it's not a yes instance, there's no input W that will cause this verifier to accept. Okay? So no matter what W is presented to us, we're never going to get fooled to think that a no instance is a yes instance. And therefore, we can be confident that if there is something that the verifier accepts, that it really is a yes instance. And this property 2 says that has to be true for every yes instance, that there's something that can prove this to us. Okay? I know this definition can be a little subtle, so I'll do an example. So here's a fairly standard example. KSAT. So this is K satisfiability. So the point here is we have a Boolean formula, and we want to know whether there's an assignment of variables in this formula that will make it true. So in particular, we have some number of clauses and the clauses have the form, I'll call them CI, and each clause will be LI1 or LI2 or ... L-I-K. So the point here is the OR of various different things. And there's K things. The OR of K different things, I should say. Okay? And that's why the K here is the K in KSAT. Okay? Now, of course, you can have less than K things in this clause. So if you want to have an example of KSAT, an instance of KSAT, it's still okay if one of the clauses has less than K things. Because you can always make it into a clause with K things by just repeating one of the L's, right? Because L or L or L is just the same as L, right? Since they're all the same, they're either all true or all false. And if they're all false, then the OR is false. And if they're all true, then the OR is true. Okay. Now the L's is equal to either some single variable, x, n sub ij, or, and this is not the log, I mean, this is the or that goes with this either, so it's not a logical operation. So it's either equal to this by itself, or it's equal to not of a variable. Okay. And the same variable can appear in many different clauses, and even in different literals within the same clause. Although there's not usually much point to that unless you're just repeating. Okay? Okay, and then the overall formula that we have is going to be the and of the different clauses. So it's C1 and C2 and dot, 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 and C sub n. Okay? And so the input size here, so normally we pick, I guess not really essential. So the input size is going to be equal to k times n. So the point is that k is a constant, right? That's a property of the language. But n determines what our actual input size is. So that's how we scale to problems of different size. Okay? And then, of course, the yes instances, we say f is in ksat. So f is some formula of this structure. And so if there exists an assignment of the variables x, so that's all the x's that appear anywhere in this formula, such that f of x is equal to true. Okay? Yeah?
I'm not really following where we are heading to.
Okay, so this is going to be an example language, and I'm about to argue that this language is an NP. Okay? And so I'm doing this because I want to define the class NP. NP is kind of a very common example of hard languages. So that's leaping ahead a little bit, but that's where we're going. Okay? Yeah? So why don't I make even a more concrete example? So let's take an instance of ksat. So here's an example for the example. So 3sat, k is equal to 3, so each clause should have 3 things. So we could have, for instance, x1 or x2 or not x3, and x1 or not x4, and x2 or x3 or x4. And let's just stop there, okay? But you could have many more of these. So you see, so the point is each of these things in parentheses is one of these clauses CI. And then we take the logical and, the Boolean and. So this overall formula is only true if every single one of these clauses is true. And within each clause, it's only true if each of these literals LI, sorry, if it's true unless each of these, all of the literals LI are false. Right? That's what the OR says. That if any of them is true, the clause is true. Okay? And the nots, of course, you know, are true the opposite. So if you fiddle around with this, I mean, I just made it up now, but it looks like you can make, for instance, these first two clauses true if you pick x1 to be true. each of these variables is a Boolean variable, so it's true or false. So if x1 is true, and then we can easily make the third clause true just by letting any one of x2, x3, and x4 be true. So in this case, I set n to be the total number of clauses. So in this case, n is equal to 3. Huh? Well, so the number of variables can be bigger, in principle, than the number of clauses. It can't really be bigger than k times n, because that's the total number of things that you have. But usually, you don't even want it to be that high. But since each clause has up to three literals in it, you could easily have three times n variables. It would be kind of trivial if you had exactly that many, because nothing would get repeated. It would be very easy to satisfy. Okay. And so anyway, so this is a yes instance. And the way you know it's a yes instance is I actually found a satisfying assignment. For instance, if x1 was true, and x2 is false, and x3 is true, and x4 is false. So you notice that in this first clause, x2 is not true when not x3 is not true, because x3 is true. But x1 is true, so that makes this whole thing true, even though only one of the three things is true. But the second one, I guess both of them are true. And the third one, you have one of the three true. So, yeah.
In case that, actually the number of variables inside each clause, instead of being like the biggest label.
Sorry, what do you mean? So the biggest label of number of variables. No, that's right. K is a constant. And K is indeed the number of things in each clause, number of literals, so number of L's. And so if you have, you could have a very, very big instance of three set with, a million variables and 100 million clauses. I don't even know if that's a big instance. But, it is kind of. Anyway, the point is that it would still be three set because each clause would only involve up to three variables. Okay. So you can see, perhaps, if you've understood the definition, that KSAT is actually in NP. And why is that? Well, in order to be an NP, what do we need? We need a verifier that takes a witness and checks whether the instance is a yes instance or a no instance. And in fact, the witness here is just the assignment of variables that makes it true. Okay? And the verifier is, so witness is X that makes of X true. And then the verifier is simply calculate F of X. Okay? And calculating F of X, that's straightforward, right? Because calculating the value of a given clause CI, that's just taking the OR of some constant number, k things. So that takes a constant time. And then there's n of these clauses. And so calculating all of those takes a time that's order n. And then taking the end of those is straightforward. You just look to see if they're all true. Okay? So overall, this verifier runs in time n, time order n. And if there is a witness, then it's certainly a true instance, right? Because that was the definition of a yes instance. And if there isn't one, it's not. And if there isn't one, then whatever x you try in here, you'll find it doesn't work. You'll get false. Okay? Does everyone understand that? Any questions? Any more questions on this? Okay, so the important thing about this class NP is that if you're given the witness X, then it's very easy to check. Well, sorry, witness I called here W. If you're given the witness W, then it's very easy to check that you have whether you have a yes instance. Okay, it's not so easy to check whether you have a no instance, because if somebody gives you W and it doesn't work, you don't know that's because there isn't any W that works, or if it's just that they gave you a bad one. If you're not given anything, then it might be very hard to find W, for instance. And in other words, to figure out whether it's a yes instance or a no instance. Okay? And in fact, that's the case, as far as we know, with KSAT. Right, you have this Boolean formula. It could be a very big Boolean formula, but it's not good enough just to try every assignment of variables, because there's many variables potentially. Right, could be order n variables, and so trying every possible and it can depend very sensitively on the exact values of the variables. Right, it could be. I mean, if you switch one thing, then the formula may change from true to false. Right, for instance, if you change x1 in this case from true to false, then this first clause is not satisfied anymore. Okay, so you could try every possible assignment of the variables, but that's, you know, if there's n of them, then that's 2 to the n possible things to try. So that's not efficient. And depending on, you know, how many variables and how many clauses you have, sometimes you can find an efficient algorithm. But there are regimes in which no one knows how to solve it. Okay? And in fact, we know that this problem, KSAT, is one of the hardest problems in the complexity class NP. So how do we know that? And what does that mean? So in particular, so we can define the notion of reduction. So we have a language L, and we say that it reduces to another language M if there exists some polynomial time function F between bit strings. Oops. And it should be the case that if x is an L, then that means that f of x is in M, and vice versa. Okay? So the point is that this function takes the instances of L, and it transforms them into instances of M with the same truth value. Okay, so the yes instances of X become yes instances of L become yes instances of M, and the no instances of X, where X is not in L, become no instances of M. Okay, and so why is this a reduction? The point is that if you could solve M, then that tells you how to solve L. Why is that? Well, if somebody gives you an instance of L, what you can do is you can use this reduction to transform it into an instance of M, and then you know how to solve M, so you can solve that instance, and it has the same answer as the original instance of L. Okay? So I find this the order here a little bit confusing. L reduces to M, but actually that means that M is harder than L. You're reducing to something harder. But it's reducing in the kind of mathematical sense. We can reduce this to something, to some other problem that we need to solve. Okay? And so then we say that M is NP complete if for all L in NP, L reduces to M. Okay? So the point is that whenever we have a language in NP, we can reduce it to an instance of M. And therefore, if you can solve M, you can solve every language in NP. And I said that KSAT was one of the hardest problems in NP. And the reason is this theorem, which is known as the Cook-Levin theorem, after the people who discovered it, which says that 3SAT already is NP complete. And of course, 4SAT is also NP complete in 5SAT, in every k greater than or equal to 3. In principle, you might think that 4SAT would be harder than 3SAT. But as a consequence of the theorem, you can see that it's in fact not. It's equally hard. Okay? Because 4SAT is a language in NP, and by the theorem, it must reduce to 3SAT. Okay? So if you can solve 3SAT, you can also solve 4SAT or 5SAT or 6SAT. Okay? So I don't have time to prove this theorem for you. It's not too hard, but it's a little subtle. And the basic idea here is that you take the verifier, which is kind of the only thing you know about the arbitrary language in NP, and you turn the verifier procedure into a 3SAT formula, such that the 3SAT formula is satisfied if and only if the verifier will accept. But you won't. That's I guess something that we don't really need to know for this course. Okay. So there are questions now on NP. If you can solve, like I said, if you can solve any single NP complete problem, then you can solve every problem in NP. Okay. But as far as we know, we don't know how to do that. I think it's fair to say that most people think it's not possible, but that's never been proven. So this is what it boils down to, right? P, the time of the class of algorithm of problems with polynomial time algorithms, NP, the class of problems that can be checked in polynomial time. As far as we know, they're not equal, but this is a famous open problem. And if you can solve it, you'll win $1 million from the Clay Math Association, along with lots of Clay Math Institute, along with lots and lots of other prizes and everlasting fame. I won't assign this homework. So let's get back to quantum algorithms and quantum complexity. So how does NP relate to these classes we defined last week, P and BQP? Well, clearly, P is inside NP. Okay? Because if there's a polynomial time algorithm to solve a problem, well, then there's certainly a polynomial time algorithm to check it. The checking algorithm is ignore the witness and just solve it yourself. Okay? So P is a subset of NP. But as I said, we believe that NP is bigger than P. So I'm drawing a Venn diagram here, and there's some things in NP that are not in P. And so, for instance, sometimes people will draw a little thing here and call this the NP complete problems. So we believe those are outside of P. And actually, we know that if P is not equal to NP, then there's also some problems that are not in P but are not NP complete. Okay. But obviously, if P is equal to NP, then that's not true. Okay. And then the class BQP, well, BQP also contains P, right? Because if you can solve it in polynomial time on a classical computer, you can write down a quantum circuit that just does the classical algorithm and doesn't use any superpositions. And that's a perfectly valid quantum algorithm. And in fact, it will always accept. So you don't have to worry about these probability things. But quantum algorithms, of course, can presumably do things efficiently that classical computers can't. And we'll see some examples of that this week. So BQP should probably be strictly bigger than P. Although, again, we don't actually know how to prove that. And it turns out that we think that, in fact, BQP contains some things that are not in NP, but that NP contains some things that are not in BQP. So in other words, we think that the relationship between these classes looks like this. So they're intersecting, and the intersection actually contains some things that we don't think are in P, but we don't think NP complete problems are in BQP, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later this week when we talk about Grover's algorithm. But on the other hand, we think there's some BQP problems where the quantum computer can give the answer efficiently, but we don't know how to check them efficiently on a classical computer. Okay? So for instance, the problem of simulating quantum systems, which is something you'll do in one of the tutorials, is something that quantum computers are very good at, of course, because quantum systems are quantum, and therefore a quantum computer should be good at them. But it's not something where there's some concise classical information and some classical procedure that can check the answer. Okay? So anyway, so this is, again, we believe the relationship between this class looks like this, but we cannot prove it. So we can't prove, for instance, that P is not equal to NP. We can't prove that P is not equal to BQP, that NP is not in BQP, or that BQP is not in NP. So basically, we can't prove anything. That's a very common problem in complexity theory, that there's some very extreme separation. So for instance, you can define a class X, which is like P, but it's things that run exponential time. Okay, there's an algorithm that solves it in exponential time. And not everything can be solved even in exponential time. Remember, some things can't even be solved at all. But we can prove that P is not equal to X. So that's kind of state of the art of what you can prove, that polynomial is not the same as exponential. But there's other intermediate classes that are even bigger than NP that contain both NP and BQP. For instance, there's a thing you can do in polynomial space, but possibly exponential time. So you're reusing the space. And that includes both NP and BQP. And we can't prove even that class, P space, is different from P. Okay. So complexity theory makes do with the occasional cases where you can prove something. Okay. So for instance, you can prove NP completeness. That's an interesting thing. And sometimes you can prove that some class is inside another. Here's some easy example where P is inside NP or inside BQP. And there are some slightly more subtle examples. So proving things are the same, sometimes you can do that. Proving things are different, that we don't know how to do. Okay. So given that people can't prove these things, why do we think that these classes are separated like this? So one answer is just that, you know, you can work very hard, for instance, to find an algorithm for 3-sat and don't succeed. And maybe that's an indication that you weren't clever enough, but maybe it's an indication that there really isn't an algorithm. Okay, so that's one route. Another route is you can study related problems in some way. And so one route that people have taken in order to do this is to look at oracle problems. So the idea of an oracle is a black box function and I think most of the oracles we'll be dealing with will take n bits into 1 bit. Okay, and so then of course an input x is going to go to O of x. And really frequently we're going to, I mean, you might want to deal with a family of oracles that work for different values of n, but I think this is going to be enough for what we need. Okay? And the point is about this oracle, it computes something, but we have no idea how it computes it. That's what it means to say it's a black box. We put in an input, we get an output, we don't know what happened in between. Maybe it's something that we bought at a store. Maybe we had to climb a high mountain and ask a priestess the answer to this question. Whatever it is, we get the answer. We don't know how we got it. Okay? And then in the oracle model, so we can ask questions. And these are known as queries. So the singular of queries is query. And a query is we give it input x and get out O of x. And based on this, we'd like to determine some property of O. So for the oracle model, usually what we're trying, the complexity measure that we try to figure out is called the query complexity. So if f is some property of oracles, then the query complexity is the minimum number of queries we have to make to determine f of O for any O. Okay, so again, this is a worst case thing. So we want to determine this property. So we have an algorithm that asks certain queries and does some calculations based on those queries. And maybe the queries it makes depends on the answers it got to earlier queries. And then we run this procedure, and we figure out our best guess for f of O. Okay, And we insist that this guess always be correct. Or if we have a randomized case, like a quantum algorithm, then it could be correct with high probability. Okay? And if you consider all possible such procedures that will give you this answer, you take the most efficient one, the one that makes the fewest queries, okay, and that's the query complexity. That tells you the query complexity. Okay? So let me give an example. So this is actually going to be a promise problem. So we're given an oracle which maps n bits to one bit. And it's either a constant function, this oracle. And what that means is that, of course, for all inputs, it has the same output. Or it's balanced. And balanced means that, that the number of inputs for which O of x is equal to 0 is equal to the number of inputs for which number of inputs y for which O of y is equal to 1. Okay? So x has there's 2 to the n possible inputs. So O has 2 to the n minus 1, 0 outputs, and 2 to the n minus 1, 1 outputs. And they could be arranged in any order. Okay? So we're given this promise. And then we'd like to know which one of these is true. Okay? So this is a property, being constant or balanced, is a property of the oracle. And that's the property we're trying to calculate. Okay? And I want to know how many oracle calls I need to make to do this. Okay? And if you think about this, since I'm insisting in this case that we have a deterministic algorithm, that it work always, if you think about this, if I only try 2 to the n minus 1 possible inputs, then I can't know for sure that it's either constant or balanced, right? Because if I try 2 to the n minus 1 and some of them are different, it has to be balanced. But if I try 2 to the n minus 1 inputs and they're all the same, it could be that it's constant. That seems most likely. But it could be that I just got really unlucky and those 2 to the n minus 1 inputs were just all the ones in one of these two sets. Okay? So the classical query complexity, deterministic query complexity, is 2 to the n minus 1 plus 1. Okay? Now, if you're willing to satisfy yourself with randomized case, then actually it's some constant, depending on what probability of acceptance you want. Yeah?
Right.
This is classical, right? We'll get to quantum in a moment. Okay? So some things to note about this query model, oracle model. So we don't care about the number of gates that we use or the amount of memory that we use or really any resource except the number of queries we make to the oracle. Of course, in real life, we do care about these things. And frequently, if you come up with an Oracle algorithm that uses a lot of gates for a lot of memory, that's considered a drawback, even if it only uses a few queries. But for the purposes of this complexity measure, all we care about is queries. So one of the reasons we study this Oracle model is that if you can come up with an Oracle algorithm, you can convert it into a regular algorithm. And the way you do that is if you have some function that satisfies the behavior of this Oracle, some explicit function where you actually know how to calculate it, well, then instead of querying the Oracle, you can just calculate that function. But on the other hand, if you have a lower bound, so if you can prove and in fact, the reason people are interested in this Oracle model is that frequently you can prove lower bounds on the query complexity, whereas in the regular case, we couldn't prove it. That, unfortunately, does not imply a lower bound on the regular complexity. And what it does tell you is that that any algorithm that beats that lower bound must use the internal structure. Of the function that you're substituting for O. Okay, so this is useful in kind of giving you an indication of what's possible, proving lower bounds on oracles, but it's not really rigorous. And so, as we'll discuss later in the week, you can have an Oracle model for NP complete problems, and you can prove, in fact, that in the Oracle model, the query complexity has to be high, either classically or quantumly. The problem is, of course, that if somehow you can use the internal structure of 3SAT or one of these other NP-complete problems, maybe you can do something that's better than these Oracle algorithms. Okay? So are there any questions so far on this query complexity model? Then maybe let's move to quantum query complexity. So, a little more space than that. So for for quantum oracle, we need some way to involve superpositions. So in particular, we need the Oracle to be unitary, right? So we want to make it reversible in the same way we made other functions reversible last week. So in particular, well, to make it quantum, we're going to put kets around everything. We're going to add some ancilla, which in this case is just going to have to be 1 qubit. And the ancilla is going to hold the answer to our oracle query. So we're going to have one register, which I guess could be many qubits. Put the X register and the A register together into the oracle. And we'll get out the X register. And then the A register will go to A plus O of X. Okay? So this should look familiar. This is just what we did for functions last week to make them reversible. Okay? And of course, superpositions. So this is true if you put in X in a basis state. And superpositions work by linearity. So for instance, if you put in X plus X prime, tensor A, then you'll get out X, here, tensor 0. You get X, O of X, plus X prime, O of X prime. Right? And that could potentially be an entangled state if O of X and O of X prime are different. Okay? Yeah.
If we ask the question that give a certain number of qubits, how many times? How many number of qubits do we need to get calculation?
Right. So in this case, O is mapping n bits to 1 bit, okay? And so to make it reversible altogether, in the final answer, we only need that 1 bit of output. Now, if you actually wanted to replace O by an explicit function that calculates it, then you might need some additional scratch bits. And you want to erase those at the end. Remember that we discussed that last week about erasing. So in the intermediate stage, you might need some extra ancilla. But in the output, you only need as many as the answer contains. Okay? So the classical query complexity of this problem here is large. Remember, it's 2 to the n minus 1 plus 1. But it turns out the quantum query complexity, if you use quantum oracles and a quantum algorithm, is less than 2, less than or equal to 2. I'm going to show you an algorithm that uses 2. And in the tutorial, you'll supposed to find one that actually takes only 1, improving slightly on this algorithm. So this is called the Deutsch-Jose algorithm. After two people. Deutsch found the first version of this algorithm, and then Jose improved it to be deterministic. So here's the circuit that does this. So here we have a bunch of inputs which start in the state 0. And here's another, basically, ancilla qubit that starts also in the state 0. On this first set, we do the Hadamard transform on all of them. And then we use those as the input to this oracle O that we're given. Remember, we're trying to find whether O is constant or balanced. And then these qubits come out. We don't do anything to them. This qubit down here, we do a phase flip if it's 1. And then we put them back into the oracle. And finally, we do the Hadamard on these qubits. and measure. And this output here so if the output is equal to all zero, then we conclude that the original function was constant. And if the output is not all zero, then the original function was balanced. Okay? So one thing to note here is that this ancilla, I mean, it seems like maybe we're not doing very much with it because we do this phase shift, but then we don't even measure it at the end. We just kind of ignore it. But actually, the point of this oracle is to erase the ancilla, and the phase shift then gets kind of conveyed back to these qubits up here, and they alter it for our measurement. Okay, so let's see how that works. Do it over here. So the first step, the Hadamard transform, well, it takes each of these qubits to 0 plus 1. Okay? And it, now we have a tensor product of 0 plus 1 over these first n qubits. N qubits. And tensor product of 0 plus 1 gives us every possible bit string on n qubits, right? So, so our initial state of zero, well, a bunch of zeros, zero. Let's do the constant, well, okay, let's do the general case. Okay, this goes to sum over all possible x, zero, with the Hadamards. And then we apply the oracle. What we get is a possibly entangled state, sum over x, x tensor O of x. Okay? And then the phase shift gives us sum over x and a phase that's minus 1 if O of x is 1. So that's minus 1 to the O of x. And then what does the second oracle call do? Well, it calculates O of x again, and it adds it to the second register. And when you add O of x to O of x, remember this is binary arithmetic, so you get 0 again. So that's erasing that O of x value. And so now we have sum over x minus 1 to the O of x, x, 0. Okay? And now is when the interesting thing happens. So now we should compare what happens for the constant case and the balanced case. So we do this last Hadamard. Okay. So, so in the constant case, this is equal to, well, O of x is always the same. It could be 0 or it could be 1. But it's always the same. So we can take it out of the superposition. It does not affect the superposition at all. We have minus 1 to sum O of some particular value, because they're all the same. And then we have sum over x of x. Okay? And we already know, and we can ignore, I guess, the second qubit, because we're not really going to do anything about it. We already know that Hadamard takes 0 to 0 plus 1 and takes n zeros to the sum over x O of x. The Hadamard is its own inverse. So if we do Hadamard again on every qubit, it'll take sum over x of x to all zeros. Okay? And as we said, if we measure that, we conclude it's a constant function. And indeed, if it's a constant function, this is always what we get. Okay? So now look what happens when it's balanced. So if it's balanced, Well, now this minus 1 to the O of x doesn't come out. Okay? But we do the Hadamard to it anyway. The last qubit isn't involved. And the Hadamard, well, it has to take us to something. Okay? But it's not clear what it takes us to. And in fact, it'll depend on exactly which balanced function we have. There are many, many balanced functions. Right? Depending on which values of x give us 1 and which values of x give us 0. But you'll notice that, so let's let psi be this state. And notice that psi is orthogonal to this state. Okay, let's calculate that. Well, that's sum over x and y of y minus 1 to the O of y x. Okay? And of course, this is equal to delta xy times minus 1 to the O of y, which is just the sum over y of minus 1 to the y, to the O of y. And it's a balanced function. Right, which means that exactly half of the y's give us a phase plus 1, and exactly half of the y's give us a phase minus 1. So for every plus 1, there's a minus 1. We add them together, we get 0. Balanced. Okay? So if psi is orthogonal to sum over xx, then when we do the Hadamard on this, Hadamard is a unitary. The Hadamard takes this thing to all zeros. And so therefore, psi with the Hadamard applied to it, this inner product also has to be orthogonal to the Hadamard applied to this. So this thing has to be orthogonal to the all zeros state. And therefore, when we have a balanced function and we measure, we never get all zeros. Okay, and that's what we wanted. Now, you could get, I think, pretty much anything else, but you never get the all zeros state. Okay? And so that solves the problem using just two oracle calls. Okay, so this is the first demonstration, really, that quantum algorithms could be better than classical algorithms. Okay, are there any questions about that? Yeah.
This is just a minor thing. Like there, where you say constant equals minus 1 to the power of what?
Yeah, so constant, I mean, this thing is equal to minus 1 to the O of any particular value, say O of 0. Because it could be that it's a phase here, right? It's just, it doesn't really matter because it's an overall phase, and we're going to measure anyway. Be consistent. Any other questions? Okay. So like I said, in the tutorial today, there's two problems. One of them is on a classical algorithm. The other one is to slightly improve this Deutsch-Jose algorithm so it only uses one query. And then tomorrow we'll start to talk about Shor's algorithm, which is for a non-Oracle problem, factoring large numbers. Okay.